I'm going to read to you a speech to begin with. As we look at what's happening to us around the world, we need to have a much larger worldview than we have. Winston Churchill said, "The farther you can see into the past, the more you can understand the present and the future." Very little of what we see done around the world today reflects a good knowledge of the past, especially the most critical knowledge of the past, which is what God gives us in the Bible. I'm going to read a speech that was given 2 weeks ago by a man named Geert Wilders, chairman of the Party for Freedom, the Netherlands, at the Four Seasons in New York, introducing an alliance of patriots and announcing the Facing Jihad Conference in Jerusalem. So the speech was given by a man named Geert Wilders of a party that lives in the Netherlands. He says, "Thank you so much for inviting me. I come to America with a mission. All is not well in the old world. There is a tremendous danger looming, and it is very difficult to be optimistic. We might be in the final stages of the Islamization of Europe. This is not only a clear and present danger to the future of Europe itself, it is a threat to America and the sheer survival of the West. The United States, as the last bastion of Western civilization, is facing an Islamic Europe. The Europe you know is changing. You have probably seen the landmarks, but in all these cities, sometimes a few blocks away from your tourist destination, there is another world. It is the world of the parallel society created by the Muslim mass migration. All throughout Europe, a new reality is rising. Entire Muslim neighborhoods where very few indigenous people reside or are even seen. If you are there, they might regret it. This goes for the police as well. It is the world of headscarves, where women walk around in figureless tents with baby strollers and a group of children. Their husbands, or slaveholders if you prefer, walk three steps ahead. With mosques on many of the street corners, the shops have signs you and I cannot read. You'll be hard-pressed to find any economic activity. There are Muslim ghettos controlled by religious fanatics. These are Muslim neighborhoods, and they are mushrooming in every city across Europe. These are the building blocks for territorial control of increasingly larger portions of Europe, street by street, neighborhood by neighborhood, and city by city. There are now thousands of mosques throughout Europe. Mosques outnumber churches in England and other nations. With larger congregations than there are in churches, and in every European city, there are plans to build super mosques that will dwarf every church in their region. Clearly, the signal is we rule. Many European cities are already one-quarter Muslim. Just take Amsterdam, Marseille, and Malmo in Sweden. In many cities, the majority of the under-18 population is Muslim. Paris is now surrounded by a ring of Muslim neighborhoods. Mohammed is the most popular name among boys in many cities. In some elementary schools in Amsterdam, the farm no longer can be mentioned because that would also mean talking about the pig. That would be an insult to Muslims. Many state schools in Belgium and Denmark only have halal food for their pupils. In once tolerant Amsterdam, gays are beaten up almost exclusively by Muslims. Non-Muslim women routinely hear the words whore, whore. Satellite dishes are not pointed at local TV stations, but to stations of their country of origin. In France, school teachers are advised to avoid authors deemed offensive to Muslims, including Voltaire and Diderot. The same is increasingly true of Darwin. The history of the Holocaust cannot be taught because of Muslim sensitivity. In England, Sharia courts are now officially part of the British legal system. Many neighborhoods in France are no-go areas for women without headscarves. Last week, a man almost died after being beaten up by Muslims in Brussels because he was drinking during the Ramadan. Jews are fleeing France in record numbers, on the run for the worst wave of anti-Semitism since World War II. French is now commonly spoken on the streets of Tel Aviv and Netanya, Israel. I could go on forever with stories like this, stories about Islamization. A total of 54 million Muslims now live in Europe. San Diego University recently calculated that a staggering 25% of the population in Europe will be Muslim just 12 years from now. Bernard Lewis has predicted a Muslim majority by the end of this century. But these are just numbers. The numbers would not be threatening if the Muslim immigrants had a strong desire to assimilate. But there are a few signs of that. The Pew Research Center reported that half of French Muslims see their loyalty to Islam as greater than their loyalty to France. One-third of French Muslims do not object to suicide attacks. The British Center for Social Cohesion reported that one-third of British Muslim students are in favor of a worldwide caliphate. Muslims demand what they call respect, and this is how we give them respect. We have now official Muslim state holidays. The Christian Democratic Attorney General is willing to accept Sharia law in the Netherlands if there's a Muslim majority. We have cabinet members with passports from Morocco and Turkey. Muslim demands are supported by unlawful behavior, ranging from petty crimes and random violence, for example, against ambulance workers and bus drivers and small-scale riots. Paris has seen its uprising in the low-income suburbs, the banlieues. I call the perpetrators settlers because that's what they are. They do not come to integrate into our societies. They come to integrate our society into their Dar al-Islam. Much of this violence in the street I mentioned is directed exclusively against non-Muslims, forcing many native people to leave their neighborhoods, their cities, their countries. Moreover, Muslims are now a swing vote not to be ignored. The second thing you need to know is the importance of Muhammad the Prophet. His behavior is an example to all Muslims and cannot be criticized. Now, if Muhammad had been a man of peace, let us say like Gandhi and Mother Teresa wrapped in one, there would be no problem. But Muhammad was a warlord, a mass murderer, a pedophile. He had several marriages. At the same time, Islamic tradition tells us how he fought in battles. He had his enemies murdered and even had prisoners of war executed. Muhammad himself slaughtered the Jewish tribe of Banu Qurayza. If it's good for Islam, it is good. If it's bad for Islam, then it is bad. Let no one fool you about Islam being a religion. Sure, it has a God and a hereafter and 72 virgins, but it is in every essence a political ideology. It is a system that lays down detailed rules for society and the life of every person. Islam wants to dictate every aspect of a person's life. Islam means submission. Islam is not compatible with freedom and democracy because what it strives for is Sharia. If you want to compare Islam to anything, compare it to communism or national socialism. These are all totalitarian ideologies. Now you know why Winston Churchill called Islam the most retrograde force in the world, and why he compared Mein Kampf to the Quran. The public has wholeheartedly accepted the Palestinian narrative and sees Israel as the aggressor. Let's skip a couple paragraphs about the nation of Israel. In my country, the Netherlands, 60% of the population now sees the mass migration of Muslims as the number one policy mistake made since World War II. Another 60% sees it as the greatest threat. Yet there is a greater danger than terrorist attacks. The scenario of America as the last man standing. The lights may go out in Europe faster than you can imagine. An Islamic Europe means a Europe without freedom and democracy, an economic wasteland, an intellectual nightmare, with a loss of military might for America as its allies turn into enemies with atomic bombs. With an Islamic Europe, it would be up to America alone to preserve the heritage of Rome, Athens, and Jerusalem. Dear friends, liberty is the most precious of gifts. My generation never had to fight for this freedom. It was offered to us on a silver platter by people who fought for it with their lives. All throughout Europe, American cemeteries remind us of the young boys who never made it home, whose memory we cherish. My generation does not own this freedom. We are merely its custodians. We can only hand over this hard-won liberty to Europe's children in the same state in which it was offered to us. We cannot strike a deal with mullahs and imams. Future generations would never forgive us. We cannot squander our liberties. We simply do not have the right to do so. We have to take the necessary action now to stop this Islamic stupidity from destroying the free world that we have known. I'm not going to say I agree with everything you said, but certainly a lot of very important things that are mentioned about this wave of people that have come from a different part of the world and are settling as an act of occupation, you might say an act of war, to control that part of the world for themselves. The reason they're doing it goes back a long, long way. In fact, about 4,000 years. I want to begin today a history of these two men who were the progenitors of what we call now pretty much the Muslim world. Let's go over to Genesis chapter 16. In Genesis chapter 16, we have the birth of an individual called Ishmael. Ishmael was an illegitimate son of Abraham, illegitimate because he did not come from a wife, but from a handmaid, from a servant girl in the house. We might blame Sarai for it, but blame, of course, doesn't matter. What matters is literally what happened and the history that has descended from that ever since. In Genesis chapter 16 and verse 1, now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. At this time they were married about 84, probably about 9-10 years. They married longer than that. He came across at 75, now he's about 85, so at least 10 years after he came across from Ur of the Chaldees. We don't know how long he was married to Sarai earlier than that, so my guess is they've been married at least 20 years, maybe 30. She has no children. So she said to Abram, "The Lord has kept me from having children. Go take my maidservant, and I can build a family through her." So legally, the child would be Sarah's, because Sarah owned the handmaid. Abram agreed to what Sarai said. So after Abraham had been living in Canaan 10 years, Sarai's wife took her to Egyptian handmaid Hagar and gave her to him as his wife, and she conceived. When she knew she was pregnant, she began to displease her mistress. Then Sarai said to Abram, "You are responsible for the wrong I am suffering. I put my servant in your arms, and now she knows she is pregnant. She despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me." By the way, I'm reading from the NIV translation. I don't use it for the New Testament because it's woefully deficient. It's about 10,000 words shorter than the King James in the New Testament. But the Old Testament, they did stick to the Masoretic text. So if it reads different than yours, it's because I'm using the NIV version today, which is okay, I believe, in the Old Testament, but certainly not one to be used often in the New. But so if it reads different than yours, you'll know why. Sometimes people come up after church, "Well, your Bible sure reads different than mine." So sometimes, of course, I can't see. Actually, this Bible has awfully small print, so I should put on my glasses so I'm not so vain about it. So, does it make me look older? I hope not. But see, it's got this real small print compared to my New King James, so it's going to be difficult to read and not fumble through the words. "Your servant is in your hands," Abram said. "Do with her whatever you think best." Then Sarai mistreated Hagar, so she fled. But the angel of the Lord found her near a spring in the desert. It was at the spring beside the road to Shur. And he said, "Hagar, servant of Sarai, where are you going? Where have you come from? Where are you going?" She says, "I'm running away from my mistress, Sarai," she answered. Then the angel of the Lord told her, "Go back to your mistress and submit to her." The angel added, "I will increase your descendants so they will be too numerous to count." So Ishmael was promised by God to have descendants too numerous to count. The angel of the Lord also said to her, "You are now with child, and you will have a son. His name shall be Ishmael, for the Lord has heard your misery." Notice what it says this man would be like. "He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand against him." Constantly fighting, constantly having and making enemies, constantly in war and turmoil. "He will live in hostility towards his brothers." Now, people might just think, well, that's some Old Testament fable, and some Old Testament story doesn't have any influence on us today. They could not be further from the truth. The truth of the matter is that there's an entire religion that worships Ishmael, along with worshiping the moon and, of course, bringing in the moon worship religion of ancient Babylon. Every year, during the month of Ramadan, millions of pilgrims go to a place called Mecca. And you've seen pictures of it. And they go around and around and around and around this building called the Kaaba. It's a very expensive white marble building. But in the middle of that building is a small box. And in that box is a set of bones. And those bones are literally the bones of Ishmael. They worship him. They honor him. They want to emulate him. And believe it or not, the religion that they have causes them in some ways to be a lot like him in the way they act. So even the National Geographic a few years ago did a special on Mecca and Arabia, and it talked about this box that contains the bones of Ishmael, and no one disputes that. They all agree that, yes, historically speaking, those are the bones of Ishmael. Now let's continue the story a little bit farther. Let's go over to Genesis chapter 25. In Genesis chapter 25, we find the account of Ishmael's sons. Let's begin in verse 12. This is the account of Abraham's son Ishmael. This is right after the account of Abraham dying at 175 years old. Abraham's son Ishmael died, whom Sarah's maidservant, or Abraham's son Ishmael, whom Sarah's maidservant, Hagar the Egyptian, bore to him. These are the names of the sons of Ishmael listed in the order of their birth. Now you'll notice some of these names are sort of similar to the names of the September 11th terrorists. Ishmael, Kedar, Abdil, Mibsam, Mishma, Duma, Masa, Hadad, Tima, or Otima, Otiman, Jetur, Naphish, and Kadima. These were the sons of Ishmael, and these are the names of the 12 tribal rulers according to their settlements and camps. Altogether, Ishmael lived 137 years. He breathed his last and died. He was gathered to his people. Notice what it says after that, verse 18. His servants, or his descendants, settled into the area from Havilah to Shur, near the border of Egypt. In other words, south of the land of Israel, south of the land that God would give to the 12 tribes. It says, and they lived in hostility towards all their brothers. Now, their only brother was Jacob. I mean, their only brother was Isaac. And Isaac, so Isaac's sons, Jacob, and then the descendants of Jacob, would be the brothers that these people, the Ishmaelites, were going to live in hostility towards. And that, of course, continues today. The important thing to know about Ishmael, or actually two things. Number one, he was the firstborn son, and he felt he should have gotten the blessing. Abraham should have blessed him and made him as the son who would receive the inheritance and the birthright. But he was rejected. He still feels bad about that. And then it says, of course, that his very personality was to be angry, was to be violent, and was to be constantly having hostility towards his brothers, his hand against every man, and every man's hand against him. Now we continue on down verse 19. This is the account of Abraham's son Isaac. So Abraham had first Ishmael, who was rejected, but he would have the blessing of having many, many descendants. Then Abraham had Isaac through, of course, his natural wife, Sarah. Abraham became the father of Isaac. When Isaac was 40 years old, he married Rebekah's daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean from Padan Aram. We know the story of Abraham's servant going over and bringing Rebekah back. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. So they'd been married 20 years, and she still had no children. So he prayed to God, and God answered his prayer. His wife, Rebekah, became pregnant. The babies, really it means wrestle. It says jostle in this version. The babies were fighting with each other when they were still in the womb. I don't know if this has ever happened since, certainly not before. So these babies were already at war with each other while they were in the womb. And it was very distressing to the mother, as we can only imagine. So she said, "Why is this happening to me?" And she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples from within you will be separated. One will be a people stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger." So God told her the older would be the servant, the younger would be the one that, by understanding, would receive the promised birthright from Isaac. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first was to come out red. His whole body was like a hairy garment. They named him Esau. The word red is literally the word Edom. So the word Edom means red. And so Esau later becomes Edom, a little bit later in the chronicle. So they named him Esau. After this, his brother came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel. So Jacob came out with one hand grasping his brother's heel. I don't think twins are normally born that way. I think normally one twin comes, then 15, 20 minutes later the other one comes, something like that. So he was named Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. The boys grew up. Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was a quiet man staying among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. So they kind of played favorites here. Once when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau came to him from the open country famished. Now, I want to stop here and read something else. As you know, there are a few, not many, but there are a few books that still exist concerning Old Testament history that are not in the Bible. And they may or may not be entirely accurate. At one point, there were thousands of books that contained the history of all the ancient world, and they were kept primarily in the library at Alexandria, which was burned to the ground by the Muslims in the 600 and 700s AD. So we lost a great deal of written history. In fact, probably lost more like 99.99% of it when that building was burned down. But they were burning it down because it the only book they thought people should read was the Quran. Fortunately, a lot of ancient history is also stored in the Vatican, especially Greek and Roman classical history, but those books are, for the most part, not available to Western scholars to go out and look. They keep most of that hidden and not available. So what few books we have, books like Herodotus and some of the earlier Greek historians, some of the Roman historians, we have to basically go on those and try to fill in the pieces of ancient history, because we simply do not have the correct histories and the ones that were written and the detailed accounts of many of the ancient empires, because that was all taken from us in a magic, huge fire. But the Book of Jasher exists. It is not as accurate, perhaps, as Josephus. The Book of Jasher is kind of a for what it's worth book, kind of like some of the other books that we have from the Old Testament history that were kept by the Jews. But for the what it's worth department, the Book of Jasher, it says, by the way, I'm reading this out of a little publication called Thy Kingdom Come. It's the publication of the Association of the Covenant People. Now, there are people scattered across Canada, primarily, some in England, a few in the United States, who have an excellent historical record of the descendants of Jacob, and of course, especially Ephraim and Manasseh, descendants of Joseph, and a lot of the historical evidence they have in some of their books that they print are good reference material. I'm not saying they're altogether accurate, but they do have some excellent material that I refer to from time to time, and I bought several of their books, and I do receive their little publication just because it does contain sometimes some excellent little pieces of information that are helpful. So in quoting the Book of Jasher, they say, we are told there was an enmity between Esau and Nimrod. Nimrod possessed the garments that the Lord had fashioned for Adam. After the flood, Ham stole the garments from Noah, passed them to his son Cush, who passed them to Nimrod. The garments were deemed to have power because Adam had been given dominion over the earth, and Nimrod credited the garments for his conquests. Now, I don't know if this is true or not. It's just a history that's written. It may or may not be true, but I think it's interesting to read. Esau was hunting in the field and spotted Nimrod. He took cover, and when Nimrod approached, he sprang on him and cut off his head with his sword. Then he fought desperately with Nimrod's two guards, killing them both. Then he stole Nimrod's garments and fled home from the remainder of Nimrod's hunting party. So he was ready to murder to acquire the dominion associated with Adam's garments. It is thought that this was the time when he was returning home, about to die, that he found Jacob cooking the pottage in the field. And he said, give me some. And he ended up being, of course, willing to trade off his birthright because of it. Now, that may or may not be what happened here. It just says that Jacob came in from hunting, from the field, and, of course, he didn't have any animals. He hadn't been hunting animals, so it's possible that that's when he did have this confrontation with Nimrod, and we really don't know. But at least it's interesting. The commentator here mentions that because Esau had this cloak or this fur coat that God had made for Adam, he felt he didn't need the birthright. That he could, because of that, he could rule the world just because he had that coat from Adam, which was supposed to have special power. It's just conjecture. It may or may not be true, but I think it's interesting to read. Well, verse 29 says, when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau came in from the field, very famished. He said to Jacob, quick, let me have some of that red stew. And, of course, Jacob said, well, sell me your birthright. Now, Jacob knew because his mother had told him. You know, the angel told me you are going to rule over your brother, even though you're the second born. But Jacob and his mother Rebekah were not willing to let God work it out. They said, we got to work this out on our own because God's taking his good old time, and you know, I'm not sure he's going to keep his word. And after all, you deserve the birthright, so why not just take it? This, by the way, is very different than King David's attitude, who was anointed king and then waited at least 13 years before he was able to be king. If he had the attitude of Rebekah and Jacob, he would have killed Saul in the cave and said, here I am, I'm your new king. But thankfully, David didn't. That's because he was a man after God's own heart. And at this point, Jacob certainly wasn't. So Jacob says, well, this is a good opportunity now to bring to pass what is rightfully mine because the angel told my mother it was. So Jacob said, swear to me first. He swore him an oath, selling the birthright to Jacob. Then the end of the chapter says Esau despised his birthright. It really means he hated the fact he had lost it. He was angry because it wasn't his anymore, and this anger continues through his descendants even to this day. So we have two people, Ishmael and Esau, who were both firstborn and both did not receive the birthright, and who were then very angry at the brother who did receive it. Now let's continue down to chapter 26 and verse 34. When Esau was 40 years old, he married Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and also Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. And they were a source of grief to Isaac and Rebekah. Now, these are just names, unless you understand that these ladies, these Canaanite ladies, were descendants of Ishmael. So we have the sons, we have Esau marrying Ishmaelite women. And so from this time forward, the history of Esau and Ishmael become entwined. They become essentially the same people. They become the same group of people and the same genetic stock, so to speak, because Esau then marries into the family of Ishmael. So the anger at Isaac and the anger at Jacob are now married in their descendants. And of course, it was very upsetting to his mother that he had married outside the family. He had not married into the family of Isaac and Jacob. Although he probably thought he did because he was out marrying these Ishmaelitish women. But of course, the mother was very upset about it. Now in chapter 27, we have the story of deceit. This is an interesting story to read to the kids, interesting story to read to us. You know, Isaac is old. They all know that he's about to die. Again, Rebekah says, well, he hasn't given the blessing to Jacob yet, so we have to go out and connive and scheme and get my husband to do what I want him to do. Now, no women have done that since then, thankfully. And none would consider doing that today, unless, of course, you watch soap operas or whatever that type of show might be. But she's definitely a scheming lady who is scheming to get her husband to do what she wants him to do. So she tells her son to go through this act, and they put, you know, this hairy garment on him or skin on him and make him you know, kind of smell like an animal in the field like Esau did. And then she cooks this stew and brings it to Isaac. We all know the story that Isaac was fooled and gave a great blessing to him, to Jacob. And then after he had finished, verse 30, Jacob had scarcely left when his brother Esau comes in. Now, of course, Esau's got this bowl of wild food he prepared, of tasty game for his father. And he said, well, who are you? He says, I'm your son, your firstborn Isaac. Then in verse 33, Isaac trembled violently, or your firstborn Esau. Isaac then trembled violently and said, who was it that hunted game and brought it to me? I ate it before you, and I blessed him, and indeed he will be blessed. He knew he could not take that blessing of Abraham back. Once it was bestowed, it would stay on the person to whom it was given. When he heard these words, he burst out with a loud and bitter cry and said to his father, bless me too, my father. But his father said, your brother came deceitfully and took your blessing. So this anger of Esau is still with us today in Esau's descendants. They still want the land that was given to the descendants of Jacob, even though God did not give them that land. They want the birthright blessing that was given to Jacob and to Ephraim and Manasseh. But he can't have it. But he's angry. And all the time he has been trying to get it ever since. And we see a resurgence of that even today. Now the blessing he gave to him, verse 37, Isaac answered Esau, I have made him Lord over you, and have made all his relatives his servants, and I have sustained him with grain and new wine. So what can I possibly do for you, my son? So in other words, all the good part of the earth was given to the descendants of Jacob, the fatness of the earth, the dew of heaven, places like, you know, the fabulous cornfields in the Midwest, the Willamette Valley, you know, the fabulous places that we've been given. Esau said to his father, do you have only one blessing? And he wept aloud. His father Isaac answered him, your dwelling will be away from the earth's richness, away from the dew of heaven. And where have they dwelt? Primarily in desert lands, in North Africa, a bunch of rocks and sand, in the Arabian Peninsula, in places in the Middle East where they can scrape out a living, where there is some, you know, some good agriculture. But for the most part, it has been nothing compared to where the descendants of Jacob have lived. It says, you will live by the sword, and you will serve your brother. But when you grow restless, you will throw his yoke off from your neck. That maybe has happened in the 20th century when the British petroleum companies primarily went into those parts of the world and began to drill oil and then pay huge royalties to those people in the Arabic lands. And of course, they've amassed fabulous amounts of money, and they've used much of that money to build mosques and export their religion all over the world. So they are living by their sword, and they would eventually be able to throw some of that yoke off their neck, but not all of it, of course. Some of this we're seeing played out, I think, before our very eyes. Then it says in verse 41, Esau held a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing his father had given him. So this grudge is a part of his personality, just like Ishmael's was. He said to himself, the days of mourning for my father are near, then I will kill my brother Jacob. Now Rebekah was told what her oldest son Esau had said to her. Now Esau's obviously very, very angry. He found out that Rebekah was a part of this, so he hated his mother, now he hates his brother. And what Rebekah is facing because of her conniving and manipulating of her husband, she's facing seeing one of her sons kill the other. Certainly a horrible thing. Just ask Mother Eve. So she said, well, I got to get rid of this guy. He needs to flee to my brother Laban in Haran. So she told him to leave, and he said, well, I've got to get permission from my father to do that. So in verse 46, Rebekah said to Isaac, I'm disgusted with living because of these Hittite women. So she didn't like these wives that Esau had brought home. If Jacob takes a wife from among the women of this land, from Hittite women like these, my life will not be worth living. So she says, well, you go on and go down to a different place to live. Now she says, go at once in verse 2 to the house of your mother's father, Bethuel. Take for yourself a wife there. Now notice what she says, that she will tell him to come home. Says, well, when it's okay, when things have calmed down, then I will come and get you. And of course, that never happened, because Esau's anger never did subside. So Jacob takes off. In verse 10, he leaves Beersheba and goes out towards Haran. So he kind of goes up to the north from Beersheba. He stopped for the night where the sun had set, taking one of the stones where he put it under his head. So this poor guy has been kicked out of his house. He's leaving. He has his blessing given to him, but he doesn't know much about what's going to happen in the future. He had a dream in which he saw a ladder or a stairway resting on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. Must have, you know, gone up hundreds of feet or maybe even a mile or more. And the angels were ascending and descending on it. So they were going, angels going up and down on this stairway. There above it stood the Lord, and he said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west, to the east, to the north, to the south. All peoples on the earth will be blessed through you and your offspring, which that, of course, has been carried out through the Savior of all the earth being born through his descendants, and also because the blessings God gave his descendants enabled them to defend freedom and to establish a much more peaceable earth for everyone. He says, I will not leave you. Notice verse 15, I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go. I will bring you back to this land. So the angel promised him, I will bring you back to this land. Don't worry about what's going to happen to you. He says, I will watch over you wherever you go. I will not leave you until I have done what I promised you. So Jacob knew that the angel of God then would bring him back to the land that had been given to Isaac and to Abraham and now to him. Jacob awoke. He said, surely the Lord is in this place. He named it Bethel. He called it the gate of heaven. Bethel means the house of God. That's a place you can still visit if you go to that part of the world. But the next morning, verse 18, he took the stone he had placed under his head and set it up as a pillar, as a monument, and he poured oil on top of it, and he called that place Bethel, or house of God, residence of God, though the city used to be called Luz. And Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me and watch over me on this journey that I am making, and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear, so that I return safely to my father's house, then the Lord will be my God, and this stone that I have set up as a pillar will be God's house. In other words, wherever this stone is, we will worship God. And of all that you give me, I will give you a tenth. Now the tradition, of course, is very clear. This stone was then taken over to Paddan Aram with him, and he brought it back later. As he came back to the promised land, it was taken by the Israelites into the land of Egypt. Moses brought it back out several times. He said, do I have to hit this rock and get you water, that type of thing. And eventually it was the coronation stone used for the kings of Israel, and was later taken by Jeremiah after the fall of Jerusalem up to Ireland and then to England. And it's today actually up in Scotland at the Scottish castle, but it is supposed to be brought back down to England whenever they have any more coronations. But the stone is called the place where the true God is worshipped, or the house of God, the place of God, and it goes back to Jacob fleeing from the threat of being killed by his brother Esau. And of course he arrives in Paddan Aram. Let's go over now to chapter 32. We don't need to go through all of the considerations of what happened with his father-in-law. He married his two wives, Leah and Rachel, there in the land. And of course he had 11 sons born to him while he was there, and one daughter. So a lot happened to him in this ensuing 14 years. Now he comes back. He does not come back, by the way, because his mother sent him a message like she said she was going to. He doesn't get a message from mom saying, oh, by the way, Esau is nicey nice, good, good now. He has forgotten about what we did to him, so go ahead and come home, it's safe. That's not what happened. Esau never changed his attitude, except very briefly, as we'll read the account here. Instead, what happened is Jacob gets essentially ejected from the land of Laban, because Laban has been dishonest with him and has been stealing his flock, has been very jealous of the way God blessed him. So, chapter 32, Jacob went on his way as he's leaving Paddan Aram to go back to where his mother and father were living, back to the place of, or had lived, back to the place in Israel, what we call Israel today, but certainly back to Bethel. The angels of God met him. Now, here he is coming back. Was this the same angel that he had seen on the stairway going up and down the stairs? Probably were. And what they said of him is interesting. When he saw them, he said, this is the camp of God. So he named that place Menahemon. Now, it doesn't tell us what they said to him. This is one of those verses where, hey, wait a minute, you left off half of the story. You know, why do we have such little amount of information? Just like I have a third of mankind's history in 6 chapters in Genesis, and we have all this in Revelation that's so condensed. So it just says he met these angels. What they probably told him is, we are going to protect you as you go back to the place God has given you. That's what we have to assume. So Jacob sent messengers ahead of him to his brother Esau. So Esau is in the land of Seir, down near the area of Petra, in the country of Edom. And he's got probably still got a real bad attitude. He's still angry. And so Jacob comes up with this plan. Maybe the angels told him to do this, to have all these cattle and sheep and donkeys be brought in several little groups as gifts to his brother Esau. And most of you know the story. Interesting here thing is that verse 17, when he put these different groups and these hundreds of animals that he was giving to his brother Esau, he instructed the leader to say, when my brother Esau meets you and asks you to whom you belong and where are you going, who owns all these animals in front of you, you are to say, they belong to your servant Jacob. They are a gift sent to my lord Esau. Now that's backwards. Remember the prophecy that was given to Rebekah, that the younger would be served by the elder. Now he's saying, no, I'm your servant and you are the Lord. So in an act of, you know, humility, Jacob is saying, I will act like you are the older brother and I'm the younger, that I'm the servant and you are the Lord, at least for right now. So he's showing him that he has no intention of gloating it over him and saying, aha, I have the birthright, I'm the Lord, I'm the big guy. He's really trying to come up with a way to ameliorate the problems that are between them. And so showed a lot of wisdom here, but it's just interesting the way they changed these two words around, the way he changed them and said, well, these are from your servant, Jacob, and they're a gift to his Lord, Esau. So that happened. He sent them all away. He said that he told the guy that was leading the second group to say the same thing. Now then Jacob went across the river. Jacob's gifts went ahead of him, and he himself spent the night in the camp. That night Jacob got up and took his two wives, his two maidservants, and his 11 sons, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. So he sends all these servants and all these animals ahead, only keeps his family with him, and they cross the Jabbok, which is a tributary of the Jordan River, a tributary. After he'd sent them across and all his possessions, he was left alone, and as he was sleeping, a man wrestled with him until daybreak. So the man saw that he could not overpower him. He touched the socket of Jacob's hip, so his hip was wrenched. So he pushed, apparently, the ball socket of his hip out of joint, bruised it very badly. He said, he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, let me go, for it's daybreak. So obviously, if it was the one who became Christ, he could have overpowered Jacob in half a second, but he chose to be on an equal level, physically speaking, and just to see how determined Jacob was to wrestle with him. Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he must have known somehow that he had to win this wrestling match. You know, if God appeared to you and said, "You want to wrestle?" I'd say, "No, you win." But for some reason, that's not what happened. So Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The man asks, "What is your name?" Jacob, he answered. The man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel." So your name is now going to be Israel because you have become an overcomer with God. So Jacob means supplanter or deceiver. Israel means overcomer with God or blessed by God. There are several different translations of it. So, but you have struggled with God and with men and have overcome. So he struggled with Laban. He struggled with Esau. And he had become an overcomer. Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." He replied, "Why do you ask my name?" In other words, he didn't tell him. So he blessed him there. Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, yet my life was spared." So the sun rises above him. He gets up to go meet his brother Esau, and he's limping. So Esau probably sort of feels sorry for him. "My brother couldn't fight with me if I wanted to. Why would I want to kill a man that's a cripple?" So he probably made, you know, some sort of a cane or some sort of a walking stick or, you know, modern-day crutches. I really doubt if he had one of them electric chairs that they ride down in Walmart, you know, with the little golf cart thing. So he's walking with a terrible limp because the socket of Jacob's hip was touched near the tendon. So he meets Esau, and conversation we all know pretty well. Esau asks him, "Well, who are these women and children?" He says, "Well, these are my family that I've been blessed with." And then, of course, Jacob said he doesn't, or Esau said he really had plenty. He didn't need to have all those animals, that God had blessed him very much. Now, Esau then said, verse 12, "Let us be on our way. I'll accompany you." So Esau invited him to come down to Petra with him. But Jacob was smart enough to realize that would probably be a deceit, that once they had gone together and the companies had joined up, that before long Esau's anger would come back, and he very likely would kill him. So Jacob has learned enough here during his years in his father-in-law's place to be very wary of other people, in this case, especially relatives who had sworn to kill you. So Jacob says, "No, my lord, you know the children that are tender and that I must care for the ewes and the cows that are nursing their young. If they're driven that hard, they'll die. So let's just part company and we'll be friends." But then verse 15, Esau said, "Well, let me leave some of my men with you." And that could have led to kidnapping, or Esau could have said, "Well, you know, wait till Jacob's asleep, then go over and cut his throat," whatever. Jacob was wise enough to say no to that offer. And so why do you do that, Jacob asked. "Just find me favor in the eyes of my Lord." So again, he called him my Lord when really he was the Lord. So that day Esau started on his way back to Seir, or Petra. Jacob went to Succoth, where he built a place for himself and made shelters for his livestock. This is why the place is called Succoth. After Jacob came from Padan Aram, he arrived safely at the city of Shechem in Canaan. He camped there, he bought a plot of land, he pitched his tent. And the last thing it says in verse 20, he set up an altar and called it El Eloi Israel, which means the God of Israel, or worshiping the God of Israel. The God of Israel is the true God. So he acknowledged that God had changed his name to Israel. He accepted it, and he accepted that his God was going to be the God of Israel. So here we have an interesting story of these two men, the Ishmaelites, and then the descendants of Edom, or Esau, who became Edom, and they both missed out on the birthright they thought they were supposed to get, and they're very angry about it, and that anger persists unto this day. Now let's go over to chapter 36. Chapter 36 is one of those odd inset chapters. You know, you're reading along in the Bible and the story's kind of flowing, and all of a sudden there's a chapter and you think, why is this chapter in here? What meaning would that have for us? And chapter 36 is nothing but a list of Esau's descendants. It doesn't tell the story of anybody. It doesn't follow the storyline that's been going on with Dinah and the Shechemites and the death of Rachel and Isaac and all the various things that have happened. It's all of a sudden just, here's this descendants of Esau stuck into the middle of the book of Genesis. But it's important because God wants us to know who these people are, because in the end times, the Bible, by the way, is written for those upon whom the ends of the earth have come, we need to identify the descendants of Esau, because the Edomites are a conglomeration of Ishmael and Esau, And those attitudes, those angers, those resentments are still with them. So in chapter 36, we won't read, of course, all of this. Esau took wives from the women of Canaan, Adah, daughter of Elon the Hittite, Aholimah, daughter of Anah, and granddaughter of Zebon the Hivite, and also Basemah, daughter of Ishmael and sister of Nebaioth. He even married a daughter of Ishmael. That's interesting that Edom married that closely into the family of Ishmael. And list some of their names and some of their possessions and all that they had. Esau dwelt in the hill country of Seir, or to the south. The land of Edom is the land where Petra and that very rocky country is. Down in verse 11, the sons of Eliphaz, one of Esau's sons, Teman, remember the Teman Empire, the Ottoman Empire? Omar, how many Omars have we heard about just discussing all the various terrorists and the people who have come from that part of the world to try to do harm to the descendants of Joseph? Zepho, Gatam, and Kenaz, all of these names mean something to us, but especially down in verse 15, the sons of Eliphaz, the firstborn of Esau, the chiefs Teman, Omar, Zepho, Kenaz, Korah, Gatam, and Amalek. And the Amalekites became the most violent and some of the most angry of the tribes of the descendants of Edom. In fact, they were the ones that came out and attacked the Israelites as they came out of Egypt. Let's drop over there, in fact, since we're, I think, pretty close here. Let's go over to Esau, or to Exodus chapter 17. Exodus chapter 17. Now, in this case, they have not yet gotten to Mount Sinai. They don't get to Mount Sinai until later. And they don't have the Ten Commandments yet. They've not made their covenant with God yet. The Edomites, as they passed through the land of Edom, attacked them from the rear. It was the Amalekites who did that. They didn't come up and try to attack the army. They were scaredy cats. They were not afraid, not courageous enough to attack the Israelites to begin with head on. They waited until the men had passed, and they attacked the stragglers, the women, the children, somewhat today kind of like the idea of suicide bombing and attacking, you know, inflicting civilian casualties, which happens all over in that part of the world, and they've used this same tactic against the Israelis since 1948. Where instead of attacking head-on, they will often attack the women, the children, the stragglers. My wife and I are going back to Israel this year on the tour. One place I want to go, I have 700 and some slides I took in Israel in 1974, and I recently bought one of these little gizmos where you can copy all your slides to a digital file so you can put them on, you know, computer and all that, which is good because the slides dry up. And this little gizmo even will do negatives. It'll take 35-millimeter negatives and make them into a full-color file to use on your computer. But I remember we were there in 1974 in June, July, and August. But earlier in, I think it was in March or April of 74, it was only about 3 months before we were there, a group of Palestinians came in from the north and attacked a place called Kiryat Shemona. Anyone know what happened there? They went into a school. It's very clearly, if you've ever read Moshe Dayan's autobiography, which I hope you all have, along with Golda Meir's and certainly Ariel Sharon's, but when I read Moshe Dayan's autobiography the first time, I thought, you know, this must have been horrible because he had to go up there and try to figure out what to do with this school full of children, and they had 8 or 10 Palestinian terrorists in there. So through a whole slug of bad things going wrong, they were trying to pretend to negotiate while they were going to have their commandos go around the back, enter the school, I think, from the vents in the ceiling, and come down and shoot the commandos who were not negotiating. So what happened is the Palestinians saw what was going on, and they lined up about 135 school children and machine gunned them all. And I remember going through, and when we went through, it was barbed wire and a fence. We could see the machine gun holes in the walls where they had lined up those kids and shot them. And it's a horrible thing. I mean, you hear about it in the news, you hear about it. Well, we hear about people being blown up today in Iraq, other places. But when you go by and you're, you know, literally from here to that white van, there's the wall, and there's a school, and there's, you know, it's just a horrible experience. So I want to go back there this time just to see if they've changed it, if they've rebuilt Kiryat Shemona, if they have what they've done in the school. And these people are the same mentality as the Amalekites. They have not changed. It is still with us today. It'll be with us until the day Jesus Christ returns. And we need to understand that these things go back 4,000 years. These attitudes, the way people think, the way they are, they are passed down from generation to generation. All that can change that is God's Spirit. And without God's Spirit, these things are going to continue, and we'll see more and more of that as time goes on. So what did God say about the Amalekites? Verse 8, the Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. We get more of the story later when Moses talks about it in Deuteronomy and says they came out and attacked us from the rear and killed our women and children. He said to Joshua, choose some of the men to go out and fight the Amalekites. So after this rear-end attack, they stopped, and Moses told Joshua, go out and attack these Amalekites. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands. So Joshua fought the Amalekites, as Moses had ordered, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. As long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning. But whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. Then when Moses' hands grew tired, they took the stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. So Aaron and Hur held his hands up one side and one side on the other, so his hand remained steady until sunset. So Joshua overcame the Amalekites' army with the sword. Notice what God says after this. The Lord said to Moses, write this on a scroll as something to be remembered, and make sure that Joshua hears it, because I will completely blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Moses built an altar and called it, the Lord is my banner. And he said, for hands were lifted up to the throne of the Lord. The Lord will be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation. And a very common greeting, especially when taxi drivers give Israeli soldiers a ride, it's by law they have to stop. When we were over there, this busload of soldiers gets out, they've all got their machine guns, and everybody stops. All the cars pull over, because by law you have to give a hitchhiking soldier a ride. But when they get out of the car, what does the driver say to the soldier and the soldiers say back? They say, Shabbat Shalom, goodbye. They say no. They say, remember the Amalekites, and they get out. That is their saying. That's how the Israelis greet each other when they've given each other a ride or they leave. And they tell the soldier, remember the Amalekites. So they're a little tougher than some of us. We were over there. I don't want to tell too many stories. I get behind again. I get so tired of myself. I sit down. My wife says, you're getting Alzheimer's. You keep telling the same stories over and over. So I apologize. But we went out to Tiberias, another place I want to go. There's like 8 or 10 of us on the dig. We're all 18, 19-year-old, you know, big Americans, big smiles and big eyes. Not a lot of experience yet. And there wasn't much going on in this pier outside the Lake of Sea of Galilee, you know, moonlit, beautiful moon shining on the Sea of Galilee. It's gorgeous. It's absolutely a gorgeous lake. It's down about 600 feet below sea elevation. But several buses of Israeli soldiers pulled up, and they came out and took over the dance floor and started playing their Israeli songs and all their dancing, and it was stunningly beautiful. They all knew every song. They ever played the same song twice in 5 hours, 4 hours, and they all did circles and danced and clapped their hands and round. There was one girl off to the side I thought was pretty cute. I thought I'd go over and talk to her and see if she could teach me to dance, but she carried a Uzi submachine gun. I could not bring myself to ask a girl to dance who was carrying a submachine gun. Plus, she might not have spoken English. She might have only spoken Hebrew. So just a note to you girls, you want to get asked to dance in 2 weeks, don't carry a machine gun here on the dance floor. So, but they do say to each other, remember the Amalekites. And they know what the Amalekite mentality is because they've lived it. They've seen their kids blown up with suicide bombs and other things. Well, I want to end today over in Ezekiel chapter 25. Next time we'll pick up and read the book of Obadiah, which is an entire book dedicated to Edom and Esau. You know, God gives us a lot about this man. We have an entire book of prophecy about him because he is important. His descendants are important players in the end time, and it's important to know what's going to be happening with them, because as these events unfold over the next few years, however long it takes, I don't want us to be deceived. We need to know who the players are, how they think, and what will be happening. It's a sad tragedy that our national leaders think that these people think like we do. They don't. They simply have a different mentality. They have different value systems. They have a different purpose in their life, and they know that what they are doing is at least wise. If they have the religion of the Muslims, which we read about, you know, there are 7 major tenets of the Muslim religion. You ought to get them out and look at them sometime. One of them is to make a pilgrimage to Mecca at least once during your life. The last one is you must increase the kum. The kum is the land owned by Allah. And that's why they support each other in any efforts to increase the kum. Most of them choose to move somewhere and have children and take it over by simple, just basically squatting and having a lot of children there and raising them all as Muslims. One time I asked Jack Scruggs back in, you all know Jack Scruggs, right, from Portland? Anyone doesn't know Jack Scruggs? You should. Jack was a CIA agent. He was a CIA agent lifer for like 24 years. He knows Bob Baer and some of the other authors in the CIA that have written, you know, best-selling books. He was the last American out of Tehran in 1978. He would have been one of the hostages for 444 days had he spent five more minutes there in the embassy before he took off and got on a car to go to the airplane. Now, his job in Iran was to look like an Arab because he speaks Arabic and he had a beard, and he just was to walk around and go into the shops, go and sit in the back of the mosques, and just listen to what people are saying, and then write it down and send it into Washington, D.C., or actually Langley, Virginia. But we were doing a television program with Mr. Davis after the 9/11, and I asked Jack, I said, well, why is it that after these horrible attacks that killed 3,000 innocent people, that there was such silence from the Muslim world? Why weren't there people all around saying, this is awful, this is wrong, it's against our religion to kill innocent people like this? He said, it's very simple, because every Muslim must do all he can to increase the kum, or the land owned by Allah, and no Muslim is allowed to criticize how another Muslim chooses to do it. So he said, most of them choose to move somewhere and have babies and just take over, but he said, if they choose military force, terrorism, or violence, no other Muslim is allowed to criticize them for it. And so we don't think like that. We Americans just simply don't. And if we think they think like us and we can go over there and impose our systems on them and our values on them, we are greatly mistaken, and we are learning that the hard way. In Ezekiel chapter 25 and verse 12, it says, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. Because Edom took revenge on the house of Judah, this is after Jerusalem fell, we'll cover that next week, next time, and became very guilty by doing so, therefore this is what the Sovereign Lord says, I will stretch out my hand against Edom and kill its men and their animals. I will lay it waste, and from Teman to Dedan, both of those words you can find in maps of that part of the world, they will fall by the sword. I will take vengeance on Edom by the hand of my people Israel, and they will deal with Edom in accordance with my anger and my wrath, and they will know my vengeance, declares the Sovereign Lord. So exactly when and how God's going to bring that to pass, we really don't know. But knowing all of these things, these forces are on the scene, and they are being unleashed like never before, it should behoove all of us to realize that Jesus Christ is going to return, and hopefully very soon, and that our job is to make ourselves ready and to make sure we are seeking God every day and that He is the highest value we live for. And we'll watch these things, we'll recognize them when they come to pass, but hopefully we'll be able to, as it says in Luke, you know, we'll be able to stand at the Son of Man when He comes and be thankful that we are there and stand there with courage and knowing that we are following God like we should. So next time we'll cover some of the later events with Edom and also cover the book of Obadiah.